Cascades or anything else specific to her. Nothing came up. But then I go and look at the actual notes and see that everyone has to use some form of user ID. Obviously, Meg wasn't going to use Meg. So I try other things. Runtmeyer. But nothing comes up. Louisa, her middle name. Nothing. I type in the names of her favorite bands, the girl rock stars that she wanted to be. Nothing. I'm about ready to give up when I try Firefly. A whole screen of messages comes up. Some of them contain references to Fireflies. And there are at least a dozen usernames that are a variation of Firefly. It seems to be a popular name, maybe because Fireflies have such brief lives. And it's while I'm contemplating the link between Fireflies and suicidal people that I see it. Firefly 1021. 1021. October 21st. Scotty's birthday. With trembling fingers, I go to the oldest one, from earlier this year. The subject line reads, Baby Steps. I have been thinking of this for such a long time, and I don't know if I'm ready, but I'm ready to admit to thinking about it. Much as I like to think of myself as a Buffy, a kick-ass, fearless person, I don't know if I'm fearless enough to do this. Is anyone? This must be how archaeologists feel when they unearth hidden civilizations. Or how that guy felt when he found the sunken Titanic. When you know something is gone, but you found it too. Because here, this is Meg. I scan the replies. There are more than a dozen of them. They are so warm, welcoming her to the group. Congratulating her on being brave enough to admit her feelings, telling her that her life belongs to her, and it's hers to do with as she pleases. And it's the oddest thing. Because even though I know what these people are congratulating her for, my first reaction is pride. Because these people met my Meg. They're seeing how amazing she is. I keep going. A lot of the missives read like they were written by sixth graders, full of typos and grammatical mistakes. But there is one at the bottom from a user called all_BS that stands out. Baby steps. Is there such a thing? Lao Tzu famously said, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." He also said this, "Life and death are one thread, the same line viewed from different sides. You have taken your first step, not toward death, but toward a different way of living your life. That itself is the definition of fearless." Chapter 17. After I read that response to Meg's email, I ran out of the library like the chicken shit that I am, vowing never to go back on those boards. It takes 2 days to break that vow. And I don't do it out of any kind of bravery. I do it for the same reason I gave in and slept on her sheets back in Tacoma. To be closer to her. Every time I read one of her posts, even though she's writing about death, she feels alive. Firefly 1021, out of the frying pan. Here's the thing that screws with my head. Afterlife. What if there is actually an afterlife, and it's just as bad as the current life? What if I escape the pain of this life only to land somewhere worse? When I imagine death, it's liberation, a release from pain. But my family is Catholic. Big believers in hell, and while I don't believe in that version of it, with devils and damnation and all that, what if there's just more of this? What if that is what hell is? FLG_3.
Hell is a bullshit Christian construct to keep you in line. Don't buy it. If you're in pain, you do what you do to end the pain. Animals bite off their own claws. Humans are more enlightened and have different tools.
Sassafras. Hell is other people.
Trash talker. If the afterlife sucks, kill yourself again.
All_BS. Do you remember pain from before you were born? Do you remember the torment from before you came into this world? Sometimes a pain is tolerable until it is touched, a tender bruise jostled. So it is with the pain of this life. It is brought about by this mortal coil. It is not death or pain that is to be dreaded, but the fear of pain or death, wrote Epictetus. Stop fearing. Stop dreading. The pain will go away, and you will be freed. All_BS. The one who called her fearless before. The one who writes incomplete sentences and quotes dead philosophers. The one who, in a twisted sort of way, makes sense. I read this latest message again, and a voice inside my head yells, "Stop talking to her. Leave her alone." As if this is still happening. As if it's not already too late. Firefly 1021. To medicate or not to medicate? A friend told me to go to the campus health center to get some meds, so I talked to a nurse there. I didn't tell her everything that was going on, not about what we've been talking about here. But the nurse started going on about the first years away at school and the Northwest effect, and it sounded like standard boilerplate. She gave me some pamphlets and samples and made me an appointment to come back in 2 weeks. But I think I'll blow it off. I've always said it's better to be hated than it is to be ignored. Maybe on the same lines, it's better to feel this than to feel nothing. It's one thing to type messages into the ether, but it sounds like she was talking to someone in the real world, too. Someone else other than me. The hot boil of jealousy shames me. It's so pathetic. I'm waging a tug of war, but no one else is holding the other end of the rope. I skim the responses. Some people warn Meg about SSRIs being a mind-control plot devised by the pharmaceutical industry. Others say that taking them will numb her soul. Others claim that humans have always used mind-altering substances, and antidepressants are merely the latest incarnation. And then, there's this response. All_BS.
There is a difference between using a natural substance like peyote to engage in a consciousness-expanding experience versus allowing a bunch of drones and lab coats to manipulate brain chemistry to such a precise degree that thoughts and feelings are controlled. Have you read Brave New World? These new miracle medications are nothing but soma, a government-produced narcotic to blot out individuality and dissent. Firefly. It is an act of bravery to feel your feelings.
Oh, Meg would have loved that. It's an act of bravery to feel your feelings, even if your feelings are telling you to die. And again, I wonder, why didn't she come to me? Why wasn't I the one she asked for help? Did I miss something in her emails? I opened my webmail, checking to see what messages she might have sent me in January, which is when she posted this one to the boards. But there are no emails between us from January. It wasn't a fight, exactly. It was too quiet to be a fight. Meg was staying in Tacoma for part of the winter break because of her work-study job, so she was only coming home for the 10 days around Christmas and New Year's. I was so excited to see her. But then at the last minute, she said she had to go to Southern Oregon to visit Joe's family, so she wouldn't even be coming home. Normally, I would have been invited to join them in Oregon, but I wasn't. Well, not until the day before New Year's Eve, when Meg called and begged me to come down. "Rescue me from the holidays," she said, sounding frazzled. My parents are driving me crazy.
Really? I replied, because I spent Christmas Day eating an $8 turkey plate at the diner with Tricia, and that was magical.
Before, we might have laughed about this, as if the patheticness of my life with Tricia belonged to someone else. But it didn't, and so it wasn't funny.
Oh, Meg said. I'm sorry. I'd been angling for pity, but now that I had it, it only made me angrier. I told her I had to work, and we hung up. And when New Year's came, we didn't even call each other. We didn't communicate for a while after that. I wasn't sure how to break the ice because we hadn't fought exactly. When Mr. Perdue grabbed my ass, a piece of news at last, it gave me the opening, and I emailed her as if nothing had happened. I scroll back to September when she left for school. I read Meg's initial emails, the Meg-like rambling descriptions of her housemates, complete with scanned drawings. I remember how I read those messages over and over, even though it physically hurt to do so. I missed her so much, and wished I could have been there, could have gone through with our plans. But I never told her that.
There's a lot that I didn't tell her,
and even more that she didn't tell me. Firefly 1021, Guilt. I keep thinking about my family, not so much my parents as my little brother. What would this do to him?
All_BS. James Baldwin wrote that freedom is not something that anybody can be given. Freedom is something people take. People are as free as they want to be. You have to decide if you're willing to grab your freedom, and if in doing so you might inadvertently set others free. Who knows what path your decision will lead your brother down? Perhaps freed of your shadow, perhaps freed to be his own person, he will be able to fulfill a potential he might not otherwise reach.
Firefly 1021. All_BS. You're bizarrely insightful. I always feel like my brother is limited by me, by my mother. He'd be a different person if we weren't around. But you can't say such things.
All_BS. Except here, we are saying them.
Firefly 1021. Here we are. It's why I love this forum. Anything goes. Everything is said. Even the things that are unspeakable.
All_BS. Yes. So many taboos in our culture, starting with death. It's not so in other cultures that see it as part of a seamless cycle, birth, life, death. Similarly, other cultures view suicide as a brave and honorable path to life. The samurai Yamamoto Tsunetomo wrote, "The way of the warrior is death." This means choosing death whenever there is a choice between life and death. It means nothing more than this. It means to see things through, being resolved. I think you have the warrior in you, Firefly.
Firefly 1021. Warrior? Not so sure I can handle a sword.
All_BS. It's not about the sword. It's about the spirit. You have to tap into your strength.
Firefly 1021. How? How do I tap into it? How do you do something that brave?
All_BS. You screw your courage to the sticking place.
Firefly 1021. Screw your courage to the sticking place. I like that. You always say the most inspiring things. I could talk to you all day.
All_BS. I can't take credit for that. It's Shakespeare. But there is a way for us to communicate more immediately and privately. Set up a new email account and post the address. I'll email you instructions, and we can take it from there. I taste the sour tang of envy again. I'm not sure if it's because I can sense the closeness between Meg and all_BS, or if it's because in her litany of people she worried about leaving behind. She mentioned her parents, her brother, but she didn't mention me. Chapter 18. I get a new client, Mrs. Driggs. She takes me through the house and we both act like I've never been here before. It's funny how once you start pretending, you realize how much everyone else is, too. The house isn't big. It's a 3-bedroom ranch style, and it already seems pretty clean because she lives there alone. Her husband is gone, dead or divorced, or maybe never there. When I was here last, it was just her and her son, Jeremy. And as everyone in town knows, he is doing 3 years at Coyote Ridge on drug charges. He got sent away a year ago, but Mrs. Driggs shows me his room, asks me to change the sheets on his bed each week, vacuum the rug. Jeremy's room looks a lot like it did the one time I came here with Meg in high school. The reggae posters, the psychedelic wall tapestries. Meg had heard that Jeremy had a snake and was fascinated by seeing it eat. So even though he was a senior and Meg and I were freshmen, she got him to invite us over. The big terrarium with its lush rainforest inside is now gone, as is the snake Hendrix. What happened to it? Did it die? Or did Mrs. Driggs get rid of it when Jeremy was convicted? When Mrs. Driggs shows me to Jeremy's room, my stomach lurches, just as it had done 4 years ago, when Jeremy had taken that mouse out of a bag and dumped it into Hendrix's cage. I hadn't expected the mouse to be so pet-like, so pink and white that it was almost translucent. The way it stood so still, except for its little quivering nose, you could tell it knew what fate was in store for it. The snake, coiled in the corner, didn't move either, didn't let on that it noticed lunch had arrived. For a while, they both just stayed like that. And then, Hendrix sprang into action and in one fluid motion, strangled the mouse. Once it was dead, Hendrix lazily unhinged its jaws and began to swallow it whole. I couldn't watch anymore, so I went to wait in the kitchen. Mrs. Driggs was there, paying the bills. "Dreadful business, isn't it?" she asked. At first I thought she was talking about the bills, but then I realized she meant the snake. Meg said you could see the lump of the mouse in the snake's body, and when she went back a day later, it was still there, although smaller. She was fascinated by the whole thing and returned a few times to see Hendrix eat. I didn't. Once was enough for me. About 3 weeks after that day together in Seattle, I get a call from Ben.
"You don't write, you don't call," he says in a joking voice. "Don't you care about the kittens?"
"Are they okay?" I ask, worried he's calling to tell me they got smashed by a truck or something.
"They're fine. My housemates are looking after them."
"Why aren't you?"
In the background I hear lots of noise, people clinking glasses.
"Where are you?"
"Missoula," he answers. "Bass player for 15 Seconds of Juliet broke her arm, so we got asked to be Shug's opening band on a mini-tour. What are you up to?"
What am I up to? I've been cleaning other people's houses and festering at my own, reading and rereading the posts between Meg and all_BS, trying to figure out where to go from here. After that last set of dispatches, their communication dwindles, so it's pretty clear they took their conversation off the boards. Only where? I couldn't find anything on Meg's computer. I found the new email address all_BS instructed her to set up on the boards, but when I emailed it, the message bounced. I asked Harry to look into it. He said the account was activated and disabled within 3 days, so Meg probably set it up solely for all_BS to instruct her how to contact him directly.
"Sounds like they were being careful," he wrote, "and so should you."
"K careful. Maybe that explains all the deleted sent emails. Meg covering her tracks. Quietly so. I also can't stop obsessing about this friend who told her to go on meds. Who was it? Some sort of confidant? If so, did Meg also confide about the Final Solution people? I checked with Alice to see if she'd mentioned meds to Meg, but Alice said no, nor had she seen any evidence of Meg taking prescription drugs. Alice asked Stoner Richard, who called me and said that he didn't know anything, but that I should try some of Meg's Seattle friends. I'd already thought of Ben, and when Richard had said that, it made me think again that he might be the confidant Meg referred to, but not enough to call him. Same old, I tell Ben.
What are you doing tomorrow night?
He asks. Nothing, I don't know. How come?
You live near Spokane, right?
Near is a relative term out here, about 100 miles.
Oh, I thought it was closer.
Nope. Why?
We're playing in Spokane tomorrow night. Last show before we truck back home. I thought you might want to come.
I open the file folder I have, containing printouts of Meg's posts. I've been going over and over them, and I'm no closer to finding out who all_BS is. I suspect he's a guy, and that he's older. But that's just a gut feeling. Maybe Ben can connect me with the mystery friend. Maybe he is the mystery friend. I don't want to see Ben. Or maybe I don't want to see him. But I need to see him. So I say yes. Getting to Spokane is expensive and a pain, because the last bus back is pretty early, and I don't want to get stuck there for the night. I ask Trisha if I can use her car.
Can't. Gonna earn me some mad money.
She mimes a slot machine and makes a ka-ching sound.
Wanna come?
Trisha loves to gamble. Maybe because it's the one area in her life where she actually has decent luck. When I was younger, she dragged me with her to the Indian casino in Wenatchee a few times. No thanks, I tell her. I catch a bus to Spokane, figuring I can talk to Ben and skip out on his show if I can't get a lift back tonight. On the ride out, I alternate between nervous and nauseated, but that's pretty standard these days. Spending all this time trying to find Meg and all_BS has put me in a perpetual state of anxiety. I've had trouble eating and sleeping. And I've lost so much weight, Trisha says I look supermodelly. It's a short walk from the downtown station to the taqueria where Ben told me to meet him. It's so hot and dry and dusty, winter having jumped right into summer without ever passing spring this year, which seems fitting. All extremes. No time for gentle transitions. Ben is already at the near-empty restaurant, in a booth in the back. He jumps up when I come in, and he looks both tired, probably from being on the road, and happy, maybe also from being on the road. When I get to the edge of the booth, we both just stand there for a second, unsure of what to do. After a slightly awkward pause, I say, "Should we sit?" He nods, "Yeah, sitting's good." There's a six-pack on the table.
"It's BYO," Ben explains. "Do you want one?"
I take a beer. The waitress sets down a basket of chips and some salsa, and I scoop some up. And I find that I can actually eat it. Ben and I drink our beers and small talk for a bit. He tells me about the tour, about the floors they've slept on, about sharing a toothbrush with the drummer because he lost his. I tell him that's disgusting, that you can buy toothbrushes at any 7-Eleven, but he says it wouldn't make as good a story. And I'm reminded that Ben McAllister is all about the artifice. We talk about the cats, and he has pictures on his phone. A sort of ridiculous amount of kitten pictures for a guy to have. Our food comes out. And we talk about other bullshit stuff. And after a while, it starts to become clear that I'm sidestepping my way around the thing I should be talking about. The reason I'm here. I take a deep breath. So, I found some stuff. Ben looks at me, and those eyes. I have to look away.
What stuff?
On Meg's computer. And then from there. I start off by telling him about the documents Harry decrypted. I planned to show him the posts Meg wrote to all_BS. I brought them with me, but I don't get the chance, because he's jumping down my throat.
I thought you said you were going to tell me if you found anything,
he says. I'm telling you now.
Yeah, but only because I called you. What if I hadn't?
Sorry. There didn't seem much point. I don't mean anything by it, but he leans back in the booth, and I can tell he's pissed.
Cowgirl Cody rides alone, huh?
He says with that growl.
Didn't used to,
I say. I push away my plate. My appetite has vanished again. That's why I'm doing this. He's silent for a moment.
I'm sorry. I know.
I press my fingers against my eyes until everything goes black. So look. Meg talked about confiding in someone who told her to go to her campus health center and get antidepressants. I thought maybe she was talking about you. He snorts.
Yeah, right.
What do you mean, yeah, right? She sent you all those emails.
There was nothing about antidepressants in them.
He pops open another can of beer.
You read them. They were like stream of consciousness. She wasn't writing to me so much as at me.
Yeah, I guess.
And I told her to piss off, Cody, remember?
He fiddles with his pack of cigarettes.
It wasn't me. It was probably one of her housemates.
It wasn't Alice or Richard, and according to them, not any of the people from Cascades. Though maybe it was. I don't know who she knew. But Richard thought it was more likely one of her friends in Seattle.
Ben shrugs. Could be. Not me, though. But why does any of this matter now?
Because if she confided in someone about the meds, maybe she also confided about all_BS in the boards. But I don't tell Ben about Final Solution. I'm worried he'll get angry again, even though he doesn't have any right to. I need answers, I say, keeping it vague.
Can't you just ask at the health center?
I shake my head.
Can't.
There's a patient confidentiality thing.
Yeah, but the patient's dead.
Ben stops, as if this is news to me. They still won't tell. I tried.
Maybe her parents could try.
I shake my head.
Why not?
Because they don't know about this.
You haven't told them?
No, I haven't told them about any of this. The secret feels larger than before, almost tumorous. There's no way I can tell the Garcias now. It would devastate them. But I keep thinking that maybe if I find out more about all_BS, enough to do something to actually help, then I can tell them. Then I can face them. I haven't been around their house in a few weeks. Sue keeps leaving me voicemails, asking me for dinner. But the thought of being in a room with them... I just can't, I say, laying my head on the table. Ben reaches out to touch my hand, a gesture that is both surprising and surprisingly comforting.
Okay, he says. We can hit the clubs in Seattle. Find out if she talked to anybody.
We? The word is a relief.
Ben nods. We head home tomorrow morning. You ride back with us. We can go around to the clubs. It's Saturday night, so everyone will be out. We'll ask around. We can go through her emails again. We'll find some answers.
That night at the show, I watch Ben carefully. The band is good. Not great, but good. And Ben does his growly, throaty, thrusty trick, and I can see his charisma. I can see the girls in the crowd responding to him. And I forgive Meg a little bit for this. He would have been hard to resist. At one point, Ben shields his eyes and peers out into the floodlights, just like he did the first time I saw him play. Only this time, I get the distinct impression He really is looking for me. Chapter 19. After the show, we crash at someone's house. I share a room with a very pierced college student named Lorraine, who's pretty nice, even if she won't shut up about the guys in the band. Ben and the rest of the Scarps camp out on the couch or in the basement in sleeping bags. The next morning, we all eat dumpster-dived bagels and then load up.
"Prepare yourself," Ben says.
"For what?"
"The reek. 8 nights of travel. You'll get a case of jock itch just sitting in the van."
The rest of the band eye me suspiciously. Do they know I'm the dead one-night stand's friend? I sit down on a makeshift bench of 2x4s stacked on top of a couple of amps. Ben sits next to me. We get onto I-90 and the guys bicker about what they should listen to. No one says a word to me. When we stop for gas and the guys go load up on junk food, I ask Ben what the deal is.
"I'm breaking the code."
"What code?"
"No girls in the van."
"Oh. But you're not a girl."
He looks embarrassed. "Not that kind, anyway."
"What kind am I?" Ben shakes his head.
"I'm not sure yet. A previously undiscovered species."
I fall asleep somewhere outside of Moses Lake and wake up with a start, leaning against Ben, my ears popping as we come down the Snoqualmie Pass. "God, sorry."
"That's okay."
He's smiling a little. "Did I drool?"
"I'll never tell."
He keeps grinning. "What's so funny?"
"It's just, you broke your promise about never sleeping in my vicinity."
I jerk away from him. "Technically, I broke it last night when I slept under the same roof as you. Score yourself a point, Ben. It's the only one you're going to get off me." His eyes flash, and for a second there's that Ben, the asshole. I'm kind of glad to have him back. But then he scoots a little away, muttering something. "What was that?"
"You don't have to bite my head off."
"I'm sorry. Did I hurt your feelings?" My voice is laced with sarcasm, and I'm not sure why I'm so pissed off all of a sudden. Ben scoots farther away, and I'm surprised to realize that maybe I did hurt his feelings. "Look, I'm sorry," I begin. "I'm tired and kind of keyed up about all this."
"It's okay."
"I don't mean to be a dick." He smiles again. "Now what?"
"Most girls wouldn't describe themselves as dicks."
"Would you prefer I call myself a cunt?"
"Don't." Ben interrupts. "I fucking hate that word."
"Really? Most guys I know seem to think it's interchangeable for female."
"Yeah. My father's one of those guys. Used to call my mother that. All the time."
"That's gross."
"What's gross is her putting up with it."
For all of Trisha's faults, and they are legion, she mostly leaves her boyfriend drama out of the house. Guys never stay at our place. She goes to theirs. If they call her foul names, at least I never have to hear them.
"Why'd she put up with it? Your mom?" I ask.
Ben shrugs.
"She got pregnant with my brother when she was 17. Married my dad. Had 3 more by the time she was 23, so she was kind of stuck with him. Meanwhile, he's out and about carousing. He has 2 more kids by his girlfriend. It's an open secret. Everyone knows. Including my mom. But she still stayed married to him. They only got a divorce when my dad's girlfriend threatened to take him to court for child support. Cheaper and easier to dump my mom and marry the girlfriend. He knew my mom wasn't the kind to sue."
"That's terrible."
"It gets worse. Mom's finally free of the bastard, and we're all older, a little independent. Things seem to be going okay. And what's she do? Goes and gets pregnant again."
"How many are you?"
"My mom had 5 kids. 4 with my dad, 1 with her current douchebag. And my dad has 2 others that I know of. But I'm pretty sure he has more. He believes birth control is the woman's responsibility."
"You're like the redneck Brady Bunch."
"I know." He laughs. "Only we didn't have a housekeeper like What's her name?
Alice, I answer.
Alice, he smiles. Ours would have to have a white trash name like Tiffany.
Or Cody. Ben looks perplexed. I remind him that I clean houses for a living. His face actually flushes.
Sorry, I forgot. I meant no disrespect.
Oh, please. It's a little late for that now, I say, though I'm smiling. And then he is, too.
So what's your story?
He asks.
My story? You mean, like, my family?
He raises his eyebrow, like he just bared all and now it's my turn.
Not much to tell. It's sort of like your story and the opposite of it. It's just me and my mother, Trisha.
No dad.
Did they split up?
Never together. She refers to him as the sperm donor, though he wasn't, obviously, because that would have meant Trisha actually intended to have me. Trisha has remained uncharacteristically quiet about my father, and over the years I've suspected it's because he is married. I picture him sometimes. In a nice house with a nice wife and nice kids. And half the time I resent the hell out of him for it. But the other half of the time, I sort of understand. It's a good life, that. If I were him, I wouldn't want someone like me to fuck that up either. Trisha thinks she raised me on her own, I continue. But really, it was the Garcias who raised me.
Meg's family?
Yeah. They're like a real family. Mom, Dad, two kids. I pause to correct myself, but look at Ben and see I don't have to. Family dinners, games of Scrabble, that kind of stuff. Sometimes I think if I hadn't met Meg, I never would have known what a normal family was like. I stop, because remembering all those times at the Garcias, watching movies on their worn couch, making plays and forcing Scotty to act in them, staying up too late by the dwindling fire on camping trips, all of that fills me with warmth. But, always the but. Ben is watching me, like he's waiting for me to say something else. But if that's what happens to normal, what hope is there for the rest of us? I ask him. He shakes his head, like he just doesn't know either. Chapter 20. We get back to Ben's house and he unpacks his stuff, and we both spend a half hour shining a flashlight around the walls and watching Pete and Repeat chase the beam. It's possibly the most fun I've had in months. Ben makes a list of the clubs that Meg most often hung out in. None of them will get going until around 11, and they'll stay happening until 4 in the morning. We pound shots of espresso at his neighborhood cafe before setting off in his Jetta. The first club is that one in Fremont I met Ben at. He introduces me to a group of groovy-looking girls in cute dresses and cool shoes. Meg people. They're all about a decade older, but that wouldn't have stopped her. When Ben explains who I am, one of the women embraces me in a spontaneous hug. Then she holds me at arm's length and says, "You'll get through it. I know it seems like you won't, but you will." Without asking anything more, I get that she, too, has been through this, has been left behind, and it makes me feel less alone. None of these women knows anything about Meg going to the health center. Most didn't even know she went to college. If Meg didn't tell them even this, chances are she didn't tell them about the final solution. I don't bring it up. We go to another club. We're barely past the bouncer when a girl with blonde, choppy hair flings herself into Ben's arms.
"Where have you been?" she demands. "I've texted you like 100 times.
Ben doesn't hug her back, just sort of taps her uncomfortably on the shoulder, and after a minute, she takes a few steps back, jutting her lip into a fake pout. Then she spots me.
"Hey, Clem," Ben says.
He seems tired.
"I've been on tour."
"Tour, huh? That's what you're calling it now?"
she says, still looking at me. "Hey, I'm Cody."
"Cody's a friend of Meg's," Ben adds. "Did you know Meg Garcia?"
Clem swivels toward Ben now.
"Seriously? Are you, like, organizing a sorority for your cast-offs? Can we, like, all wear matching outfits?
She rolls her eyes and pouts for real now. Then she makes a disgusted pff sound before flouncing off, giving Ben the finger as she goes.
Sorry about that,
Ben says, to his shoes.
Why should you be sorry?
It was a while ago,
he begins, but I wave my hands to stop him.
You don't have to explain anything to me.
He starts to open his mouth as if to say more, but then he spots a guy with thick horn-rimmed glasses and the most elaborate pompadour I've ever seen. He's standing with the girl with short bangs and bright red lipstick.
That's Hideki,
Ben says. He knew Meg pretty well. Ben introduces us, and we talk for a bit, but neither Hideki nor the girl he's with know anything about Meg or the health center. After a while, I run out of questions, and Hideki asks about the cats.
You know about the cats?
The girl he's with tells me that Hideki donated $100 to their rehabilitation fund.
So he feels invested, she says.
$100, I say. You must like cats.
I liked Meg, he corrects. She also saved me at least that much money when she fixed my amplifier.
She fixed your amp?
He nods.
Swapped the volume pot and showed me how to do it. I was skeptical, but she knew how to handle a soldering gun.
Yeah, she did, I say. And the cats are fine. Ben adopted them, actually.
Ben?
He gives Ben a look I wouldn't exactly describe as friendly.
Yeah, even has pictures on his phone.
Ben, show him your pictures.
Another time,
Ben says tersely.
We should hit some more clubs.
We go to three more places. I meet all these people who knew Meg, who miss Meg, but no one knows about the health center. I get some names and email addresses of other people she was friendly with. By 4 a.m, we have no direct leads, but a bunch of contacts to follow up on. I'm so tired. My legs feel like they might collapse from under me. And the whites of Ben's eyes are redder than Stoner Richard's after a few bowls. I suggest we call it a night. When we get back to his house, he leads me to his bedroom. I stop in the hallway outside of it, like it's radioactive in there. He looks at me.
You crash in here. I'll sleep on the couch.
That's okay. I'll take the couch, I reply.
It's more comfortable here and quiet.
I wince. Sorry, Ben, but there's like a petri dish of half of Seattle's female population on your sheets.
It's not like that, Cody.
I scoff.
Really?
Clem was a wild...
Oh, forget it. I'll just change the sheets for you.
I'm fine to take the couch.
Let me change the damn sheets, Cody.
I can't blame him for being pissed. It is 5 a.m, and he did just come back from an 8-night tour of sleeping on floors and in vans. But even so, he makes the bed, plumping the pillows and pulling down the comforter in one corner so it looks all inviting. I snuggle into the pillows. The cats scramble to the foot of the bed and tuck in there, their nightly spot, I gather. I hear Ben brush his teeth, and then I hear the floorboards creaking under his feet. He stops in his doorway, and for a second, I'm scared he's going to come in. And for a second, I'm scared I might want him to. But he just stands there.
Good night, Cody.
Good night, Ben. I sleep until noon and wake up rested, the achiness I wear like a second skin gone. When I go into the kitchen, Ben's already up, drinking coffee and talking to his housemates, whom he introduces me to. He's eating a bowl of granola and offers me some. I can get it, I say. I find a bowl from the drying rack and the granola from the cupboard. And it's weird how I'm making myself at home here. Ben grins at me, like he recognizes the novelty of this too, and then chats with his housemates about the tour. They're nice. Not the rocker types I'd expected, but students and people with jobs. One of the guys grew up in a town about 20 miles from where I live, and we lament the state of eastern Washington, stuck in some kind of time warp, and question why, when you cross the Cascades, heading east, do people start talking with southern accents? The sun is out and Mount Rainier is lording it over the city. And it's one of those days that make you forget what happens here between October and April. After breakfast, Ben and I walk down the steps leading to the yard. Off to one side is a big bunch of lumber, all covered with a tarp. "What's that?" I ask Ben. He shrugs. "Just something I do in my multitude of spare time." I pull up the tarp. Under is the beginnings of some shelves, all clean sloping lines like the ones up in the house. "You made these?" I ask. He shrugs again. "They're really good."
Don't sound so shocked.
Not shocked. More like mildly surprised. We sit down on the wooden steps and watch Pete and Repeat chase leaves and tackle each other.
"They do know how to enjoy themselves," he says.
"What, wrestling?"
"Just being."
"Maybe I should come back as a cat." He gives me a sidelong glance. "Or a goldfish. Some dumb animal."
"Hey," he says, mock offended on Pete and Repeat's behalf.
"Look how easy it is for them. What good is all of our intelligence if it makes us crazy? I mean, other animals don't kill themselves." He watches the cats, who have turned their attention to yanking on a fallen twig.
"We don't know that for sure. Animals might not swallow poison, but maybe they stop eating or separate from the herd, knowing it means they'll be someone's dinner that way."
"Maybe," I point at the cats. "Still, I'd like to be carefree like that again. I'm starting to doubt I ever was. Were you?"
Ben nods. "When I was little. After my dad left. Before my mom hooked up and got pregnant with my little sister. Me and my brothers used to go exploring. We'd go swim in the river, or build forts in the forest behind where we lived. It was like being Tom Sawyer."
I looked at Ben, trying to imagine him young and unburdened.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" he asks. "You don't think I've read Tom Sawyer?"
I laugh. It's a strange sound, that.
"I've read Huck Finn, too. I'm very intellectual."
"I don't know if you're intellectual, but I know you're smart. Meg would have had no patience for you if you weren't, no matter how pretty you are." I feel myself blush a little and look away.
"You're no stranger to pretty, Cody Reynolds," he replies. "For a dick, that is."
I turn back to look at him, and for a second I forget about everything. And then I remember that I can't forget. "So, I have to tell you something else." Ben's eyes, they change, like a traffic light going from green to yellow. "I found other things from Meg, things she'd posted on this suicide support group." Ben cocks his head. "It's not that kind of support group." His eyes change again from yellow to red. "Stop." But I can't stop. "You should probably just read it. I brought a printout. It's up in your room with my stuff." I follow him upstairs in total silence, the warmth of the day replaced with a chill, though the sun is still plenty strong. I pull out the big sheaf of papers. "You should start at the beginning." I watch him read, and it's like watching an avalanche. First a few drifts of blowing snow, and then a wave of it, and then his entire face is collapsing. The sick feeling comes back, magnified 100 times over by what's playing out all over his face. When he puts down the last page, he stares up at me. And his expression? It's awful. It's fury and guilt, which I can handle because I'm used to them, but also fear and dread, which set off bombs in my gut. "Fuck," he says. "I know, right?" I say. "He had a hand in it, in her dying." But he doesn't respond. Instead, he goes to his own laptop and brings it to the futon. He opens up his email program and goes to Meg's emails. He scrolls through them until he finds the one he's looking for. It was written 2 weeks before she died.
"Read,"
he says in a ruined voice. He points to midway through the screen. "I haven't been coming to Seattle as much lately, as you've probably noticed. And I have to admit that at first it was because I was feeling kind of low and awkward about what went down between us. I still can't believe I acted the way I did. But it's not like that anymore. Remember a while back you told me to find someone else to talk to? I have. A whole bunch of someones. Some incredibly intelligent people who have a very contrarian way of looking at things. And you know how that's always appealed to me, going against the grain. I think it's why I've always been drawn to music and to bands and to things like that. But you guys don't have the lock on rebellion. There are so many avenues. There are so many ways to live, to define what living means for you and you alone. We are so narrow in our thinking, and once you understand that, once you decide to not abide by these artificial constraints, anything is possible, and you are so liberated. Anyhow, that is what I've been learning from this new community, and they are really helping me. I have no doubt people will be surprised by the direction I take, but that's life in the punk rock world, right? Anyhow, I gotta run. I've got a bus to catch. I finish reading and look up. Ben is crouched on the corner of the futon.
She was trying to tell me, he says, about her fucked up suicide group. She was trying to tell me.
You couldn't have known from that.
She was trying to tell me, Ben repeats, in all those emails. She was trying to tell me, and I told her to leave me alone.
He slams his fist into the wall. The plaster cracks, and then he does it again, and his knuckles start to bleed.
Ben, stop it!
I leap over to his corner of the bed and grab his fists before he can punch the wall a third time.
Stop it! It wasn't your fault! It wasn't your fault! It wasn't your fault!
I repeat the words that I wish someone would say to me. And then suddenly, we are kissing. I taste his grief and his need and his tears and my tears. Cody, he whispers my name, and it's the tenderness of it that shocks me back to reality. I leap off the bed, cover my lips, tuck in my shirt. I have to go, I say.
Cody,
he repeats.
I have to get home now. I have to work tomorrow morning.
Cody,
he implores. But I'm out of the room, the door slamming behind me before he has a chance to say my name again.
Chapter 21. Trisha's in a good mood. The weekend I lost big in Seattle, she won big at the Indian casino. So even after paying for the expenses of food, hotel, and gas, she comes home $200 richer. She fans out the 20s that night at dinner and says we should splurge on something. For Trisha, this usually means something expensive and useless that she sees on the home shopping network, like an ice cream maker that she'll use twice and then turn into a receptacle for more junk. "What do you think we should get?" she asks me. "A year's worth of internet?" "Why do you keep going on about that?" I don't say anything. "There is a guy," she smirks at me. "I knew it all along. You better not get pregnant." If there is one thing Trisha has pounded into me over the years, it's not to make the same mistake she did. "You've been to Tacoma, what, 3 times now? And you want an internet connection so you can go into chat rooms and do what you do? Don't tell me it's not a guy." After the kiss, Ben tried to get me to calm down, but I grabbed my stuff and started walking toward the bus station, and he was forced to give me a ride. In the car, he said,
"It's okay, Cody."
And I said, "How can you say that? I don't know if she can see us, if she's up there or down there watching us. But if she is, she's disgusted. You know that, right?" He shrugged.
"Maybe. Who knows?"
"I know. And it doesn't matter anyway, because I'm disgusted." He didn't say anything else after that. At the station, I asked him to forward me all those long emails Meg had sent him, And after that, never to contact me again. It's not a guy, I tell Trisha now.
If you say so.
In the end, she buys a decorative fire pit. I have read every post I can find written by all_BS. He doesn't post that much, but he posts enough that it's clear he's there, paying attention. And the name? all_BS? What's that all about? Is it short for all bullshit? As in, these boards are all bullshit? Or as in, life is? One day, on the way home from the library, I see Sue driving out of the parking lot of the fried chicken fast food restaurant. My impulse is to duck out of the way.
Need a ride?
She asks, pulling up alongside me. I peer into the car. There's no Joe, no Scotty, just a big bag already seeping with grease. Sue moves the chicken to the back seat and opens the door for me.
Where are you headed?
She asks, as if there are multiple possible destinations. Home, I say, which is true. Trisha's waiting for me, I add, which is not, but I'm worried she's going to invite me over, and I can't face that, especially right now, with the folder full of Final Solution printouts in my hand.
We haven't seen much of you, Sue says. I've left you some messages.
I'm sorry, I've been busy.
Don't be sorry, she says. We want you to get on with your life.
I am, I say. The lies slip off my tongue so easily now, they barely register as untrue.
Good. Good.
She looks at the folder, and I start to sweat. I think she's going to ask about it. But she doesn't. The silence grows and gapes between us, shimmering like the heat on the empty asphalt. It's not a big town, and within 5 minutes we are home. I'm relieved to find Trisha's car in the driveway, if only because it backs up my story.
Maybe come for dinner one night next week? Sue says.
She glances toward the bag in the back seat. The deep-fried smell has now settled throughout the car.
If you come, I can make the chili you like.
I'm starting to cook again.
Chili would be great, I say, opening the door.
As I shut it, I catch a glimpse of Sue's face in the side mirror, and I understand that we're both of us liars now. The next day, I clean Mrs. Driggs' house. It's one of my easiest jobs because it is usually immaculate. I strip her bed, the sheets smelling like old lady, even though Mrs. Driggs can't be more than 10 years older than Trisha. I scrub the bathtub, self-clean the oven, Windex the windows. I save Jeremy's room for last. It creeps me out a bit, the ghostliness of it, vacuuming the shag carpet, still bearing the treads from last week's cleaning. I push the vacuum into the corner where Hendrix's cage once sat. Something clatters in the motor. I switch it off, get down on the floor to inspect what's inside, and find a bobby pin, the kind Mrs. Driggs uses to pull back her bun. So, she haunts this empty room, this empty house. She should get a pet or something, maybe some cats. Much better than a snake, although cats would go after mice too. Still, it wouldn't be such a rigged game as it was when Jeremy fed Hendrix. The victim and the victor, predetermined. Poor fucking mouse. I'm sitting there with the bobby pin in my hand when it hits me. How to find all_BS. He's the snake. To get him, I have to be the mouse. Chapter 22. What makes someone appetizing to someone like all_BS? Why did he choose to help Meg and not, say, Sassafrance, or the guy who always asks about rat poison? And how can I get him to think I'm one of those people?